Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, one woman who managed to get out of the rat race and make it as an artist. Also, Bristol's Peace Vigil, the ancient peace campaigners that started it back in 2001. Also, someone who now is helping us on Dialect, who used to work on the US magazine Stars and Stripes for the Forces and Cashflow Influence. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen Square, on 0117 989 7733. Or you can visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But first this week, let's go up north to Lancaster to see Jenny Latouche. And she's an artist who used to get in the rat race. She's now out of it all and exhibiting at Covent Garden.
My name's Jenny Latouche and I'm a sand gazer. Basically, I'm an artist and micro photographer. After getting a degree in textiles, I became a children's wear designer. I wrote television programmes, had a TV production company, and then somehow accidentally ended up in the rat race for 10 years. Last year, I emerged out of the rat race and decided to wash my hands of it all, reinvent myself, and get back to being a creative person. And I'm now a sand gazer.
Well, tell us about how the rat race sucked you in.
After working very hard at BBC and producing programmes that were great fun and took me all over the world, I had a bit of time out. I got married and then went travelling. I spent a lot of time in New Zealand and scuba diving around the South Pacific, and I came back, tried to get more telly ideas commissioned, and it wasn't happening. So my husband at the time decided to start up a franchise. I had this crazy idea to have a treehouse hotel in the Lake District. This was about 12 years ago, and I didn't have the finances to do it. So I said to my husband that I would help him get this franchise off the ground, and then I would go away and do the treehouse hotel. 10 years later, after the government changing things and the recession and a change of government, it meant that I went on a bit of a roller coaster. So my personal rat race was we bought a franchise of a company called the Property Search Group. They had 84 franchises. We bought the last remaining franchise, worked initially from the spare room at home, and then probably we grew it a bit too quickly. So 3 years later, we were working around the corner, a little cottage around the corner in little Lancashire village. And then 3 years later, we ended up with 65 staff, and it kind of ran away with us a bit. Then the government changed things. We were doing basically legal services for property professionals. But then the government had this great idea to bring in something called home information packs. I don't know if you can remember that. So we had to, we're a small independent company and we had to protect our business. Otherwise, some big national company would come up and take the part of the pack that we were doing the searches away. We ended up having to do home information packs, but part of the home information pack, there's an energy performance certificate. So we ended up having to get 25 domestic energy assessors to do those. So, you know, it was just, this is the thing, when you have a company and it grows and it grows and you just get more and more people on the payroll, it gets quite scary. So then when the government decided that actually they would delay the bringing in of home information packs, we had 25 people on the payroll and we couldn't afford to really pay them. So you can hemorrhage a lot of cash very quickly, as we did, and it was a very hard time.
Well, how did you come to decide to do what you're doing now?
That company morphed into another company that we set up 4 years ago. We spotted a gap in the market for something that we hoped would be recession proof, and we thought it was a good idea to help speed up the conveyancing market and make it a better price for consumers. We did that 4 years ago and it's gone really well, but it's been a lot of very, very hard work. I did the marketing for that company and helped to put it on the map. So I had to work on a shoestring, run up and around the country, make as much noise as possible, with no budget. But finally, we are, so thank you, Twitter. finally, last year was in a position to be able to kind of step off the treadmill and reinvent myself and do something else. So here I am, exhausted, knackered, looking at sand.
So why sand? What attracted you about sand?
I think when you spent so many years prostituting your soul, working for something that isn't really ticking all your boxes inside and making you deeply happy, I went to the Outer Hebrides and I sat on a beach and I had a bit of a moment, stayed with this mad artist. Well, I thought he was mad at the beginning of the holiday. And after 4 days, I thought, hang on, he's not mad at all. This man has got it all sorted. He's completely following his heart. He's living here how he wants to live. He's built his own boat. He's made his own fishing, lobster pots, and he was singing at the top of his voice and looking at the birds, and just he was so incredibly happy. I almost didn't believe his happiness. I couldn't quite believe that he could be this happy with so little. And then when I came back, I found it very difficult to concentrate in meetings, and I found myself gazing out of windows, and it was time to leave. And I needed to do something that was creative again, and I needed to do something that did tick all those boxes inside of me. But I didn't know what it was because I'd kind of got lost. I had really lost myself, and it's like, how do I get back to that? So I made a bit of a list of things that make me happy. On that list, then things that make me truly deeply happy, so not just like chocolate and red wine, but things that really get to the core of what make me happy. And fundamentally, it was things like, it was the elements. It was, who doesn't like watching a sunset or a log fire or walking down a beach combing? And it was really simple, basic things that are free. And I also remembered that I loved, at school, I loved looking down microscopes. I loved art. But I also loved looking down a microscope, but I wasn't very good at science because I wasn't interested in labelling. So I thought, well, I'll buy myself a little microscope. You can get them now for about £5.95 attached to your iPhone. And I'll start looking at things. I was doing a search on the internet for microscopic images, and I came across this image of sand grains. It kind of blew me away. I just thought, hang on, how come we don't know that sand looks like that? I had no idea how beautiful it was, and I was quite stunned. It was a bit of a revelation, so I did a bit more research, and I found that, there's loads of geologists that have looked at sand, but they're just labelling it, and there weren't really any artists that have looked at sand that I could find, apart from one guy, Dr. Gary Greenberg in Hawaii. And he'd written a book. I bought his book. I contacted him by email. We had a bit of banter. And I thought, well, this is what I want to do. I want to look at sand.
So what have you done with sand?
Well, I didn't have any plan in my head. And I want to make that clear because I think I'd become, after 12 years of rat race, I kind of thought, I just don't want any more plans and strategies and deadlines and targets. I am sick to death of that. I've seen something I love and I'm just going to see where it takes me. So I simply put a message on the internet just saying, if anybody's on holiday near a beach or you live near a beach, could you maybe send me a little bit of sand and I'll send you a prezi? And it was lovely, actually, because I got back in contact with people that I hadn't really exchanged communication with for several years, many years. And these little parcels of sand started arriving through the post. I would send off little thank you prezzies. And I started looking at my sand with my £5.95 microscope. And then I thought, oh, I think I need a better microscope. So I spent 60 quid on a microscope. And I was looking even closer into the sand. And then I just thought, I'm just loving this. And it's all so different from all over the world. And you don't need to, it doesn't need to come from somewhere miles and miles away to be amazing sand. You know, I've got some beautiful grains from Morecambe down the road from where I live here in Lancashire. So you don't need to travel far. So I just kept collecting it, still no plan. And then one day I was looking at the most amazing grain of sand. It looked like a flying saucer. It was outstandingly beautiful, and I'd accidentally super glued it to my finger, actually, because I'm not a scientist. I don't really know about microscopes. I am making this all up as I go along, and I was trying for the first time. It was such an amazing grain of sand. I was trying to stick it onto a little slide, and at that point the door came open, and I'd work in this fabulous co-housing place in Lancaster. It's a complete one-off, and it's that's another story in itself. But we get a lot of visitors and a lot of people that are interested in what's happening here as a community, as a creative community. And a couple of guys came in, and I was concentrating on my grain of sand that I'd stuck to my finger, asked me lots of questions. And it turns out that they were the representatives for TED, TED Talks in Lancaster. They asked me to do this talk. Lancaster Uni. I initially said no because it felt very private what I was doing, and I wasn't really, didn't know what I was doing. I didn't feel ready to share it with the world. But then I thought, well, I am excited, and it would be good to share some of this excitement with the world. And so I did do this TED talk, and then there was lots of spin-off after that.
What sort of images have you got? Is it all photography?
The images that I've taken so far are mostly photographic images that I take via my microscope, via my computer. I've got a camera that attaches onto my microscope. I've now got an even slightly better microscope. I often photograph by candlelight because I'm interested in that fire, earth, water thing. And I get, well, I think they're beautiful images. They're, you know, they're quite dreamy. I never know what I'm going to get because I use quite a slow shutter speed. So you've got this lovely sort of, when I'm in the darkness of my little dark room by candlelight and I'm waiting, click my button. I have to wait sometimes 30 seconds, a minute to see what's going to come up. And then, you know, sometimes it's nothing, and sometimes there's something that looks really quite ethereal and just beautiful. I'm still finding new things every day. They're all so different. There are star shapes. There are just undescribable shapes. Lots of them, they look like children that look at them say, are these sweets? Some of them look like sweets. They're every colour you can imagine, every shape. Some of them look like sort of three-pronged icicles. They're apparently, some geologist has told me, they're sponge spinicules or spicules or something. Lots of fragments of coral, and but the colours are astounding as well, every colour of the rainbow. And then sometimes, like the going back to the sand grain I was talking about earlier, I got this sand grain from Cornwall, and it looked like a flying saucer. It was clear disc shape with a kind of grey splodgy flower on top, and then inside it, it had these perfect purple coils spiralling out from the centre. Mind-blowing.
I know you've taken the opposite view as well, which is rather than zooming right into the sand, getting a long way away from it and above it, even, you know, sort of aerial photography.
Yeah, that sort of came about accidentally. I've always been interested in fractals, repeating patterns in nature. You know how the close-up can look like the far away, the veins on a leaf can look like a river delta, which can look like the patterns that you might get round a pebble on a beach when the water's kind of channeling into it. So there was a fundraising event and I won this little flight from Blackpool Airport. So I went up with my camera and did some sand gazing from way up high. I'm looking at sand from lots of different aspects, the patterns that you just see with your naked eye when you're walking down the beach, as well as far, far away and very close up.
So how do we find your work? I mean, have you got a website, that sort of thing, or exhibitions?
Yeah, I have got a website. I thought I'd better have a website when I did that TED talk. So it's sandgazer.com. I've also got Twitter account and Facebook. And I've actually got an exhibition, which I still can't quite believe it's true. I'm still pinching myself, but somebody's asked me to have an exhibition down in Covent Garden in London, so I'm quite excited about that.
Jenny Natouche there from Lancaster, the sand gazer artist who's exhibiting at Covent Garden. And good luck to you, Jenny.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, I'll never let it be said, even though we're all volunteers, that dialect is not professional, because we've now got a real professional on our team. Louisa Latorre has been helping dialect for a few weeks, and she's worked in professional magazines, one of them being Stars and Stripes in the United States, which is an army magazine, I believe. Hi, Louisa. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Now, Louisa, first of all, tell us about your origins. You grew up in Spain, didn't you?
Yes, I grew up in Spain. I was born in Madrid and I was raised in Barcelona and in the south of Spain, Jerez de la Frontera, actually. And then I moved to the United States when I was about 21 years old. And I lived in California for a while and also worked at a military base in Japan, in Atsugi in Japan, and then I went back to Washington, D.C., went back to the U.S., lived in Washington, D.C. for a while, and after a little bit of time in Spain for a few weeks, then I decided to work here for a few months. I decided to move to the U.K. and just try it out here.
Well, tell us a bit about Spain, first of all. What's the difference between the Barcelona, Madrid, and the South?
Well, Barcelona is very much Europe. The south is just different, and then Madrid is
sort hotter, of hotter in the south, or what? I would imagine it's near Africa, isn't it?
Well, it's near Africa, yeah. But I mean, it's
different,
more
culture?
Relaxed. Yes, different cultures, very relaxed, very laid back, and just very nice and very nice food, very relaxing, very hot. And then Madrid is a bustling city; is one of the capitals of in Europe and the capital of Spain, and it's really busy, tons of different cultures, really big, big city, big city life.
So I have to ask you, as a Spanish person, what is your favourite part of Spain? If you were talking to someone like me, an Englishman, and I have one chance to visit Spain, which part should I go and see?
I would definitely recommend Madrid, and very, very, very specially go to the south of Spain and go to Granada, which was the last part of Spain that remained it was part of the Moorish stronghold. It was the last city to be conquered by the Christians. They kicked out the Moors, you know.
Ah, right. So it was, because of course the south of Spain for a long time was Muslim, wasn't it?
It was Muslim, yes.
And so Granada, it's got a bit of history to it.
Yeah, it was the last city that was conquered by the Christians. And after they conquered Granada, the whole kingdom of Spain became Christian. They had been for centuries working on, you know, one city and after another city, trying to reconquer and bring everything back into Christianity. You know, it was the plan. It was medieval times.
Because we've got a lot of history. Spain and England had very, very, you know, look, we had battles, didn't we?
Yes.
We had a lot of fighting, particularly on the sea.
Yeah.
And and we were vying a bit in America, weren't we? Mm-hmm. England was conquering taking over North America. Yes. I mean, they said they discovered it, but of course, you know...
Who knows?
They didn't really. There was plenty of people there who'd already discovered it when they arrived. And the Spanish largely and the Portuguese in South America. Mm. So how did the Spanish view the English in history? Is there a real rivalry?
Well, now the situation is different because lots of Spaniards came to the UK. But I don't think we talk about it that much. I think that we are mostly concerned with Portugal and especially France when it comes to history because we are neighbors. So we don't get along with the neighbors that much. We get along with countries that are a little bit farther, like the UK is. But Germany, UK is fine. But Portugal and France, not so much. It's just because they're neighbors.
Okay, so we had Christopher Columbus, didn't we, from Spain, and John Cabot sailing out of Bristol, kind of around about the same time. It's fascinating, I think, the history.
John Cabot apparently was Italian.
That's right, I know. We had to import someone. Maybe we didn't have anyone who was good enough in England here to do the job.
Yeah.
And also, of course, the Spanish Armada, lots and lots of history there. But anyway, what was it that caused you and took you over to the US?
Marriage, long time ago, I met somebody and I married that person and I ended up living in the US for quite a long time, although that relationship was over a long time ago. But yeah, and then I decided to stay in the US because it's a country that treated me well. It's just that I was really burnt out after working in Washington, D.C. can burn anyone out. And it was a lot of, it's just a lifestyle that I no longer wanted to live. I worked at a newspaper, a news source, which is part of the American Department of Defense. And I had a really busy life. And at one point, I just didn't want it anymore. I wanted something out of life.
Well, I mean, you know, you just give us an idea of a sort of day for a journalist can be pretty hectic, can't it?
Yeah, although I did not work as a journalist, I worked in the marketing department. The Stars and Stripes. But yeah, it's hectic for everyone. My ex-boss, who was the marketing director, she had a very hectic life. Everybody else does. It's very normal for people to get up at 4:30 in the morning,
wow,
have long commute from the Virginia, Maryland area. There are like three states that converge in the area, Washington, D.C., which is its own state, and then Maryland and Virginia. And it's just states in the United States are as big as European countries, if not bigger. So people come from all over the place. You know, everybody converges in the city. People work over there, and then they have to go at the end of the day. And
so, I have to ask you, was your editor a bit like the sort of general in the army?
Stars and Stripes had...
Or managers, you know.
It was basically... When I worked over there, it was basically very civilian at that point. But in the past, it had lots of people in the military. People that used to work there, lots of them have been in the military in the past.
Okay, so what about California? You said you spent a bit of time there. Was it a bit easier in California?
It was nice. It was nice. It was where I lived. It was not that close to LA. So it was a rural area, which is Ventura County. Yeah, it was in the news. There was a train derailment, and it is actually where I used to live in Oxnard, the Ventura County area. It's very rural. It's north of LA, like 60 miles away from LA.
Again, hot?
Nice weather. I wouldn't say hot, no, because it's too far. It's too close to the water. So it's not... The more you go towards, you know, the mainland, towards away from the sea, the hotter it's going to be. But LA, San Francisco, Santa Barbara, all those cities are by the water, which is what makes them just nice. There are lots of Brits that live in LA and California area.
So you've worked quite a distance around the world, and you're now in Britain. How does Britain compare to these exotic places?
Well, to me, Britain right now is very exotic, I have to say. I like it very much. I like the countryside. I like, the weather takes some getting used to. But I love the cities. I have been traveling as much as I can around here. It's very, very nice. I love the countryside, the cities, the art, the monuments, the history that America doesn't really have.
So do you think you'll stay here?
I hope I will. I really, really like it. I hope I can stay here for a very long time. I was in the U.S. for 20 years. I was in Japan for about 3. So now I'm looking forward to staying here for many years.
And we're looking forward to hearing some of your reports here on Dialect. So, Louisa LaTorre, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Just after the September the 11th attacks, Bristol started a peace vigil in the city centre. People holding up placards and cars honking as they went past for peace. This was a pretty unique thing, actually. Nowhere else in the world had such a long-running peace vigil, which ran for nearly 10 years. Back in, as it had happened, I spoke to 3 people, both of whom who could remember the guns and the bombs of the Second World War. And so let's revisit that. Just a couple of years after it started, back in about 2003, I spoke to those that started the Bristol Peace Vigil.
Well, my name's Frank Deverell. I've been on the vigil now for just under 3 years. And I think the vigil is very important because otherwise these terrible things would be happening and nobody would be doing anything about it. And the way things are at the moment, so many people just kind of read it in the newspapers and then just don't take any notice of it at all. So I think it's important that we get more people out on the streets, more people becoming anti-war, and eventually get the government to become more anti-war instead of just trotting along like they are at the moment and being pro-war.
Frank, how old are you?
82.
And so that means that you have lived through the Second World War?
Yes. Yes, I have, yes.
Can you see any similarities between the Second World War and what's going on now?
With the Second World War, there was some justification for stopping the Germans, whereas this present war that we're having, the invasion of Iraq last March, 18 months ago, that was simply a grab for the oil and to establish, I think the Americans wanted to establish a military base in the Middle East so that with their Israeli allies, they could control in the whole of the Middle East and make sure that all the oil there came to them and their friends, and also make a profit on it, of course, as well.
What were you actually doing during the Second World War?
Oh, I was in the Air Force, yes. I was a pilot in the Air Force in Fighter Command. And, I went into the Air Force in 1943. So I stayed within the Army of Occupation in Italy, in Austria, and then came home at the end of the war.
OK, Neville, can you just tell us why you come to the vigils and tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes. Neville Cowrey. I've lived through 2 world wars. I think that's enough. So the fact that it's the vigil is against war completely is the most important reason. And I joined the vigil in Bristol, called a peace vigil, a few days or a week or so after September the 11th, 2001. And what I find now is this terrible business of the war on terrorism. This can't possibly defeat terrorists in the same way that you can attack a country. In fact, the very business of a war creates more terrorists. And the terrorism starts, America in particular, but now Britain, stepping up their wars to defeat terrorism. They're actually producing more terrorists all the time. The same that Putin is doing in Chechnya. More terrorists. He and previous governments, right from the Tsar, in fact, up through the Soviet Union and so on, to right up the present time, they've been trying to defeat the Chechens, who wanted their own separate country. They're a separate people, separate language. They wanted a freedom.
What about World War II? What were you doing during World War II?
I was on the RAF as well. But I was not flying. I was in a department which was fairly close to the pilots and the people who did fly, in what was called an intelligence department that was concerned with the supplying escape, means of escape, concealed compasses and so on. If they landed in enemy territory, they had some means of finding their way around. Also supplied maps to the pilots and the navigators, etc. That was the main job.
So you were helping the war effort then. Yeah. Why not now?
Well, it was an anti-fascist war, wasn't it? I would say that a number of mistakes were made prior to that. In fact, the government, prior to the beginning of the war, had it linked more closely with the Soviet Union, it might have stopped Hitler. But it didn't do it, refused to do it. It wasn't until Hitler attacked Russia and the Soviet Union came in to the war that there was any possibility of defeating Hitler. The war on two fronts finally did it.
Now, Lois, can you tell us something about yourself and why you come along to the vigils?
Yes, well, I'm now 85, so I was 20 when World War II broke out, but my anti-war feelings started when I was 15, so what's that, 70 years ago? So I was appalled, of course, by what I grew up in the shadow of World War I and saw the maimed and the legless sitting around in the streets begging and all that sort of thing as a child. And then, of course, I learnt more about the horrors of the trench warfare and the masses of people. And nowadays, one can hardly remember what that war was about. So that's one of the things that sort of was the basis of my own kind of attitude to war and violence of any kind. And so it went on. And, of course, there was only 20 years between World War I and World War II. I was born in 1918, so then I was 20 when the war broke out, working in Met Office, meteorology and forecasting particularly. Became very much closely associated with the RAF, and so experienced my friends dying in that one, and that's sort of another spur to my hatred of the whole thing. Yes, I mean, it would seem that we had to go in against Hitler. I'm sure there were various things we could have done of the run-up to it which might have prevented that. However, having done it, we did it. But because even in World War II, well, you know, there was unnecessary violence. I think the bombing of Dresden, for example, when, you know, it was a sort of tit-for-tat stuff going on, and which is always comes out in wartime. And violence begets violence. And as Frank was just saying, you know, about what's happening now with terrorism, that terrorism is the result of war making.
That was Frank, Neville and Lois, who started the Bristol Peace Vigil just a couple of days after the September the 11th attacks back in 2001. A little bit of history.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
I'm Angela Balassi, and I will be speaking to Tony Gosling about Sir Malcolm Rifkind and Jack Straw, who have had their whip withdrawn over a sting. The two former foreign secretaries have been suspended from their parliamentary parties after being secretly filmed, apparently offering their services to a private company for cash. Conservative Sir Malcolm Rifkind and Labour's Jack Straw both say that they have broken no rules. Reporters for the Daily Telegraph and Channel 4's dispatches pose the staff of a fake Chinese firm. So, Tony, what wrongdoing are they accused of?
Well, both of them are accused of offering to sell their services, that is, the access. Basically, they're selling their contact book and the fact that they can make introductions to high-level people in the civil service and in big companies here in Britain to this Chinese company, fictional Chinese company. I suppose why the Malcolm Rifkind example is considered more serious is the fact that he is actively overseeing Britain's intelligence services. Now, it might sound like a bit of a joke, but we don't really know who these intelligence services are. A lot of them are secret. But one thing we do know is that it includes MI6, which is the Foreign Intelligence Service, what they call SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service. Also MI5, which is the Domestic Counterintelligence Service. That's, in other words, their job is to stop foreign powers and subversives operating here in Britain to subvert the democratic process. Some would say even the government is subverting the democratic process these days. So that's MI5 and MI6, but also, of course, the very important GCHQ. That's the Government Communications Headquarters in Cheltenham, where there's been very serious allegations made there. In fact, evidence by Edward Snowden, the US whistleblower, the CIA contractor who's now in Russia, that there's been criminal activity going on at GCHQ. In other words, that they have been, for example, when people have been taking GCHQ to court, that GCHQ have then been spying on the lawyers and the people who have been taking them to court and then using that information basically to help them to fight a court case. Now, this really is seriously criminal offences that it's quite obvious that GCHQ have admitted to doing. But they're hiding behind this veil of national security, this blanket coverall so-called national security. The other thing is not just lawyers that GCHQ have been spying on, it's also journalists. We've had lists of people at the BBC that have been being spied on, their email accounts looked into at GCHQ. So Sir Malcolm Rifkin's job is an extremely important one, to make sure that somebody in that job is doing a very rigorous job in defence of the public interest. And it's been quite clear over the last few years, particularly since these Snowden allegations, that Rifkin doesn't see that there's a problem with GCHQ spying on journalists or on lawyers. And so he's not been doing his job effectively, many people would say. So this may be quite good. And the other thing about Rifkin is he's got many other jobs outside Parliament. Now, he was recorded saying, "I'm self-employed." Well, he quite clearly is not self-employed. That is a lie. He is employed full-time as an MP for a sum of £75,000 a year. He seems to think that he doesn't have to work full-time and he can have lots of other directorships, which is fine if it's just maybe one or two and it's a few hours a month, maybe, as a director. I don't think anyone's going to quibble with that. Those directorships include companies like Unilever, a very powerful, massive international company with monopoly positions in many markets. But most importantly, he's also an advisor to one of these consultancies to the arms industry. As a consultant, as someone who's paid by the arms industry, how can he be somebody who's actually overseeing the intelligence services, who of course spend a lot of money in the arms industry? So there's an absolutely fundamental contradiction of interest and a conflict of interest right from the very start with Malcolm Rifkin, and it's good to see that finally he's been forced to go, even though it's been obviously very reluctant. It's the end of a parliamentary career. I notice also, I haven't seen it in the English press so much, but the Scottish press, because he was Secretary of State for Scotland in previous governments, that I think it was STV dug out some figures to do with how much he was being paid from these other directorships and consultancies. He's actually on a salary last year from all these different jobs, including as an MP, of £500,000. So he's getting £500,000 in his pocket every year. And I don't think really it's fair for him to just say, you know, that he's self-employed when he's on such a massive amount of income, and also he's taking a salary as a full-time MP.
Do you think there was also a breach of security?
Well, quite possibly, because, of course, this is a Chinese firm he's dealing with. China is a potential enemy of the United Kingdom, unless some deal has been done behind the scenes we've not been told about, where Britain has got some massive strategic alliance with China against other countries, say, for example, the US or the Soviet Union. You know, what is going on when someone who's in such a key position as chairing Intelligence and Security Committee is doing backdoor deals for cash with the Chinese? Amazing.
And Labour leader Ed Miliband has written to the Prime Minister calling for a ban on MPs having second jobs. Do you think that's fair?
No, I don't. I think he's missed the point entirely, actually, because I've absolutely no problem with an MP who's got, say, a directorship in a firm. I mean, that will take up maybe a few hours reading through board papers, working for that firm, and maybe a board meeting every 6 weeks, every couple of months. And I don't think that is really seen as a problem. It's just what kind of firms you're working for. OK, so if your job and your post as a government official crosses over with the work that you're doing as a director, then no way should you be doing that. But if it's not linked, then I think that's absolutely fine. I don't have a problem with that at all.
And do you think MPs are paid enough? Do you think there should be a pay rise?
I don't know about... Well, a lot of people would say they're paid too much, wouldn't they? But I think £75,000 is a reasonable amount because, you know, you really one of the first things you need to do is to employ staff. I mean, you need to do that. I think you get a bit of an allowance to do that as well. But, you know, 75, it doesn't actually go a long way when you think about what you've got to do is actually run a really effective. I mean, I don't know how much you've used your local MP, Angela, over the years.
Not much, no.
I mean, one thing is I would say to everyone listening, if you try and use the government bureaucracy in one way or another way and it doesn't work, whether it's to do with getting housed, getting your national insurance credits sorted out, whatever it is, your tax, say you get a letter from the tax people and they say you owe this much and you don't think they do, well, there's all sorts of things you can do. You can go to see a lawyer, you can go to the Citizens Advice Bureau, but one of the best things you can do is pick up the phone or get on the typewriter, if you've still got one, and write to your MP or speak to your MP. Go to your MP's surgery and have a chat and say, well, look, hang on, I think my phone's being bugged and I've got this evidence for it. You know, things have happened where it looks like someone's listening in. This kind of stuff, it might sound a bit paranoid, but, you know, it may be that the MP is the only person who's going to be able to sort that out for you. So it's very important those MPs are there to help us and serve us, you know, because some will do it well. And I won't say who I think are the good ones and bad ones around Bristol. Maybe that's not fair. But being a Member of Parliament, you know, you're representing something like, I think, on average, about 15,000 people. And let's make sure that they're well paid enough for that job. At least if it's a good person that's elected, they need to be able to do the job well. If they're not doing their job properly, hopefully the constituents will figure that out for themselves and vote them out at the next election.
Well, we say it's well paid, but they argue compared to maybe the national average or compared to what a head teacher would earn or a police superintendent, they say it's actually below that. So given their responsibilities, do you still think it's...
Well, there's pressure, isn't there? Mm. From if you think about it, and in fact we had this with the MP's expenses scandal back a few years ago, it's very difficult in times of austerity, and it's a whole other interview, Angela, to talk about whether austerity is a very good idea or not. Certainly many economists, including Steve Keen, think that austerity is going to cause a further crash because it means that there's just less people being paid less and there's less money circulating in the economy. So that means the economy stalls because people can't buy things, businesses start going bust. It's, you know, it's a pretty obvious knock-on effect. But in that situation of austerity where there's cutbacks right across the country, it's very difficult politically to justify an increase in pay of MPs, even, you know, maybe in line with or a bit more than inflation, to say, well, hang on a minute, such and such is getting paid this, a lawyer's getting paid this or whatever, why can't we be paid at roughly the same amount? Mm. So what they did with the expenses crisis is they said, well, we won't give you a pay increase. Back in, I think it was 2009, wasn't it, 2008, around the time of the financial crisis. And what we'll do is we'll allow you to claim a load of extra things on expenses. And then, of course, many MPs were caught in the trap. They did start claiming more and more on expenses, and including duck houses. I think that's probably the most famous thing that was part of the expenses crisis. But do note the way the Daily Telegraph used that, and the Barclay brothers that owned the Daily Telegraph, was that there was quite a lot of MPs who were politically, say, should we say, close to David Cameron, and also including Tony Blair, who did not get their expenses exposed to the public. So there was that was used as a political whip to whip those MPs who were maybe more left-wing, and it was used as a tool to embarrass those MPs that maybe Cameron didn't want to be a major feature of the government when he came in a few years later.
Do you think this is a political tool?
The
latest with Jack Straw and Rick
well, King? I mean, it's been fairly equal, hasn't it? That both both senior politicians from both major parties have been caught in the sting. Jack Straw, you see, doesn't have anywhere near the enormous amount of power. I mean, just think about the Intelligence and Security Committee, how much money that committee oversees of our money, these intelligence agencies, totally unaccountable, apart from through that committee, has to spend. He has an immense amount of trust, an immense amount of power. Now, I don't know the figure, but I would say it's in the, you know, several billions of our money the intelligence services are spending, MI6, MI5 and GCHQ, and yet we see nothing of where it's been spent, pretty much, other than, you know, that we hear occasionally, don't we, on the TV and the radio, 20 teraplots have been foiled. You know, that kind of thing, and we're not allowed to know any more about it, and we just have to take it on trust. Personally, I don't trust them.
Okay, and Jack Straw apparently said he could use his influence to change EU rules, or he had used his influence to change EU rules on behalf of a firm which paid him $60,000 a year. So obviously we're not just talking about a second job, we're talking about influence. Do you think this is just the tip of the iceberg?
Well, it could well be, couldn't it? I mean, what if they tried that on all of the senior politicians and retired politicians? I mean, particularly the problem is those who have been high up in politics, like... for example, Jack Straw or others who've then left Parliament and gone into major roles, and then they are doing work which is rather similar to that stuff that they were doing while they were in governments. Particularly, I think the big worry is where people have been involved whilst in government in privatisations, and then they find they retire from Parliament, stop being MPs and walk straight into massive boardroom jobs, very, very well-paid jobs. People like Tony Blair I'm talking about really here. And this is becoming a little bit too much of a habit where people do stuff in the Parliament for us, supposedly, which is actually very beneficial to big corporations and to, should we say, international trade bodies, this kind of thing. And then they're actually not really interested in us. They're interested in what nice job they're going to get when they step down from Parliament.
And they charge between £5,000 and £8,000 a day.
Well, wouldn't you? If you could get away with it. I think Tony Blair charges even more, doesn't he? But, you know, this is the world they live in, isn't it? And it's some would call it lobbying. Others might call it bribery. So you're saying, well, we'll pay you this money if you do this dodgy deal for us. So I don't think it's at all healthy, but... you know, let's not say that people shouldn't be directors. I mean, what about being a trustee of a charity, for example, and an MP? I mean, I think that's okay, but each needs to be absolutely publicly open and accountable. And thankfully, the rules are getting better. But the thing is, how many journalists are out there checking to see what each MP is up to? That's the question.
Do they have the resources to?
And the other question, of course, is has it been working that the standards in public life where somebody writes in, for example, and says, I don't think that this MP should be doing this job because they've got a conflict of interest. There was a body called the Standards Board of England. And guess what? And then the Cameron government came in, that is to say the coalition government, they abolished it. So it's now overseen by guess who? David Cameron. I mean, for example, he went along to the Bilderberg conference back in 2013 in Watford, and really that is he shouldn't have been there because it is a secret conference, and this is organisation which controls most of the money in the Western world. They meet once a year in the summer somewhere in one of the NATO countries, and so he's waltzed in there swearing an oath of secrecy when he goes in. So he's basically broken his own rules, and he's in charge of overseeing the rules. So we're in a situation where actually we've got pretty much lawlessness at the top because people are looking at the main chance when they leave office.
Do you think this will change now in light of these revelations?
Well, I hope so. They always say it. One of these scandals seems to come up every 3 or 4 years, and they always say we're going to do something about it. Will they this time? Well, let's just keep our fingers crossed. They said for years and years there was going to be a Northern Ireland peace settlement, and there never was. And then suddenly we had the Good Friday Agreement at the end of the 1990s, and there's been peace since then, thank God.
And what do you think the future is for Jack Straw and Rifkind?
I just think that their name is mud now forever. We're not going to be seeing them in Parliament. And you know, I would say that's a good thing, because they should not be selling their influence in this way. You know, I think it's just totally wrong, particularly to a potentially enemy power. I mean, China is pretty much a dictatorship. There's no democracy in China. Very, very little free speech. In fact, it's almost Goebbels-like propaganda system they've got over there. And although there's lots and lots of very intelligent up-and-coming young people, the government is pretty totalitarian. So they should not be taking money from these people to give China influence at the top of British society.
OK, thank you, Tony.
Thanks, Angela.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Jeff Sparks, what's on?
Thank you, Tony. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 6th of March, Reef will be performing with support from Tax the Heat at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £18.50 each and doors open at 6:30 p.m. Also on 6th of March, Big Boy Bloater and The Limits will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £9 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, I present The Goons. In their time, they were the cream of British comedy and had their own radio comedy programme, The Goon Show, which was broadcast from 1951 to 1960 and featured Spike Milligan, KBE, Sir Harry Secombe, CBE, and Peter Sellers, CBE. This song was recorded in 1956 and is titled Blood Knocks Rock and Roll Cool.
You got to rock and roll in a roll call way. You got to march with a Marilyn Monroe sway. You got to rock and roll with your old kick bag. But you mustn't ever mention her name in the mess. And if you want to know the title of this number, it's a Major Dennis Budnut rock and roll call rumba. Left, 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 right, left. Quick, slow, quick, quick, slow. In, out, in, out. Pick up your gun, shove a bullet up the spout. That's a dance they do from a dress to Pango Pango. It's a Major Dennis Blood Knock rock and roll called Tango. Hoi, dum, diddle, floaty ho. Bumbay, bibby, bada cha. Yum, diddle, doo, doo, doo.
Stop that simple, naughty record type music. Stop it, I say. Stop it, oh, stop it.
Oh, sodom me putties and sodom me toppy. Why, do me beady old eyes deceive me, or is it? No, no, it can't be. But yes, it is. It's me old childhood sweetheart, Spotty Minnie Bannister. The darling of Roper's Lighthouse. Bless my soul, madam. Oh, what are you doing here? Nothing catching, I hope.
I just came to put my bag full of money in the bank, Neddy.
Money? Money? Oh, Neddy, take Miss Bannister in a steaming love dance while I check her properties. One, two, three, four.
Gents to the left. Ladies to the right. All join hands. Pan it.
Bravado, bravado, what a voice! What a bank balance! I beg you, you gorgeous wanton, give me some small token of your love and I'll sing you a known military melody. Music, Maestro Ponky.
Right, mate.
You got to rock and roll in a monetary manner. If you want to earn a necessary tenner, take your pick while the picking's good. If you don't pick right, things will never get better. And when I hear the tink of money, that is good news. It drives away the blood, not rock and roll called blues. So let there be always some cash for me.
That will be mine.
Send only 2 and 6 pence for a copy of this record. Oh.
That was the Goons with Blood Knox Rock and Roll Call. For more information on them, you can check out www.thegoonshow.net. Into Saturday, 7th of March, Karma Control will be performing with support from Angry Badgers at the Louisiana in Wapping Road, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on 7th of March, the Smiths Tribute Act, The Smiths Is Dead, will be performing at the Lanes, which is at 22 Nelson Street, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and the gig starts at 9 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care. Goodbye.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest Jenny Natouche at sandgazer.co.uk, to Peace Vigilers Frank Neville and Lois, and also Angela Balassi and Louisa Latore, also studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now. Thank you.
Take some beating, pop pickers.